So, folks, we got one more job to do together. Let me ask you, are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
Are you ready to win?
Yeah!
Are you ready to elect Kamala Harris our next president of the United States?
So I guess that's how he spent Labor Day. Wonder what Trump did.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We'll discuss.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, hey. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. Up in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. And it is very good to be back with you again. Last time we took off just a few days, Joe Biden had quit the presidential race and endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, for the top of the ticket in what would eventually become the most unprecedented last-minute shakeup and potential reversal of fortunes ever in a modern U.S. presidential campaign.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking.
That was the last time Desi joined.
Yep.
I'm happy to say this time, during our last chunk of days off before the November 5 presidential election, it was, at least by today's standards, a fairly slow news week, I think.
By today's standards.
Correct. The Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump, desecrated America's war dead for a campaign commercial at Arlington Cemetery. And Kamala Harris did a perfectly average interview with her running mate, Tim Walz, on CNN. Donald Trump apparently claimed that it's just fine to interfere with elections, that he can't understand why anybody would, you know, charge him with a crime for that. Oh, and Donald Trump also announced that he was both for and then on the very next day against a constitutional amendment on the ballot in Florida this November that would protect abortion rights in the disgraced and criminally convicted former president's newly adopted home state, where the procedure wants a constitutional right for all. Until Donald Trump packed the U.S. Supreme Court to take away that right, is now banned by both by Florida's big government Republicans after just 6 weeks before many know that they are pregnant. As usual, Donald Trump has now taken both sides of that issue, hoping that no one will notice and everybody will somehow like him.
Yeah, and the corporate media is weirdly disinterested in this flip-flop in 24 hours.
Well, had he flip-flopped on fracking, then maybe that would be something they would ask him endlessly about. But we'll get to that a bit later. And Donald Trump also announced, by the way, that he was not only in favor of in vitro fertilization, or IVF, which opponents of the right to abortion would also like to ban, but he said that if he was elected president again, he would somehow make that procedure free for everyone. Yep, Donald Trump now claims to be in favor of, well, Medicare for all, at least when it comes to fertility treatments, which, if you ask me, while a fake and phony and pandering position by Trump, of course, that he obviously just made up on the spot, Well, Democrats, I think, should immediately congratulate him on that opinion and on that position and join him to embrace the modern GOP's first baby steps toward universal free health care for all. We'll see. So far, I'm not sure why Democrats and the Harris-Waltz campaign have not taken that step, to my knowledge, but it seems like they should. Call his bluff, use it to move toward more government-paid universal health care available to all Americans moving forward. Why not? The climate was not so nice while we were out, with record heat indexes across much of the Midwest, deadly flooding at the Grand Canyon, and some other stuff that Desi will just begin to break down for us later in this hour in the return of the Green News Report.
Yeah, it's weird how stuff keeps happening.
After a mere week away, lots to cover there as well. But by and large, anyway, for these days, it was a relatively quiet week in the unofficial final week of summer before the Labor Day holiday, though the news did not wait for the holiday weekend to fully end before kicking into higher gear. As is usually the case, after folks start returning from the summer vacations, particularly in a presidential election year when things get really, really crazy. Here in the U.S., before travelers even checked out of their weekend hotel rooms, more than 10,000 hotel workers at 24 hotels stretching from Boston to the West Coast to Hawaii went on strike early Sunday morning, disrupting vacations during a busy Labor Day weekend. But after all, what is Labor Day for if not to support American workers and labor unions? The hotels were all still reportedly open, but guests dealt with skeleton staffs as Unite Here, the union representing the striking workers, said they were striking not just for better pay, but also for better working conditions, including the return of automatic daily room cleaning that many hotels dropped during the pandemic. By Tuesday, according to CNN, the massive American hotel strike got bigger still. Baltimore hotel workers joined the nationwide strike, with approximately 200 hotel workers walking off the job at the Hilton Inner Harbor on Tuesday morning. Hotel union workers are now on strike at hotels across 9 U.S. cities, with as many as 10,200 hotel workers at 25 major hotels having walked out, though as planned, 840 of them went back to work on Tuesday. These are by and large meant to be 3-day strikes. The union says the travel and hotel industries have recovered from the pandemic, but worker salaries have not reflected that comeback. During COVID, everyone suffered, said Gwen Mills, the international president of Unite Here, in a statement on Sunday morning. But now the hotel industry is making record profits while workers and guests are left behind. The major hotel chains facing striking workers right now include Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott, which have more than 23,000 rooms between them in a bunch of major cities, including Baltimore, Boston, San Diego, San Francisco, San Jose, Seattle, as well as Honolulu and Kauai in Hawaii. Also Greenwich, Connecticut, according to the union. The union is threatening to possibly expand the strike to as many as 65 hotels in 12 different cities, possibly adding hotels in Oakland, California, Providence, Rhode Island, New Haven, Connecticut. As I noted, these strikes are set to end after 3 days, but as the union says, more are likely to come in the days ahead, and that's how to celebrate Labor Day, if you ask me. And how did the Democratic nominee for president, how did she celebrate Labor Day? Well, according to ABC News, in their first joint campaign event since the Democratic convention, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris celebrated Labor Day by addressing a packed Pittsburgh Union Hall on Monday night. They spoke at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW, Local 5, in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania. The pair delivered informal remarks as part of the campaign's Labor Day blitz around the country, making a concerted effort to court union workers ahead of the November election. Biden and Harris touted their pro-labor record, of course, in office and contrasted it with former President Donald Trump's. citing 16 million new jobs so far, including 800,000 manufacturing jobs. Biden pledged that Kamala Harris would, quote, build on his union record if she wins election. He went on to vow that, quote, she will be a historic pro-union president. Biden cited the hundreds of thousands of new jobs created by the administration's executive actions and landmark legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law, and warned that Trump, if reelected, can repeal and revoke those historic initiatives.
It's all at risk because of Donald Trump, literally. With a stroke of the pen, he can get rid of a lot of this. And do you think this guy gives a damn about your pensions?
No, I'm
serious. Do you think he loses even an instant of sleep over it? Do you think he cares about all the work you do every day and how hard it is?
No.
Do you think he cares about good-paying jobs for hard-working people who built this economy? He regards picket lines. He'd rather cross one than walk one. But I have no problem walking the picket line. Never have, neither, nor does Kamala. We'll always walk alongside you. Union workers built this country. And again, that's not hyperbole, that's a fact. Folks, I promise you, if you elect Kamala Harris as president, it'll be the best decision you will have ever made.
Yeah.
And Kamala believes as I do, the unions are the spine of this economy. She'll be a historic pro-union president. So, folks, we got one more job to do together. Let me ask you, are you ready to fight? Are you ready to win?
Yeah.
Are you ready to elect Kamala Harris our next president of the United States of America? And in the process, are you ready to make Donald Trump a loser again?
That guy's pretty good. He should run for something. Vice President Harris followed up the president at the event, covering how labor unions have been instrumental in securing protections and better working conditions for all workers, including, by the way, non-union workers, like overtime pay, weekends, paid family leave, paid vacation, and more. You can thank a union member for all of that, and she pledged to always have the back of all of America's workers. She said that with just 2 months to go before the November 5 election, the race is going to be, quote, a tight race to the very end. She's right. And she described her ticket as the, quote, underdog in this race before drawing a stark contrast with Donald Trump's approach to labor and to American workers.
Together, we are fighting to build an economy that works for all working people. And that has always been the vision of the labor movement. And that is the vision of our campaign. You know, in this election, there are two very different visions for our nation. One, ours, focused on the future. The other, focused on the past. We fight for the future. We fight for a future of dignity, respect, and opportunity for all people. We fight knowing it's some backward thinking for those folks to have been suggesting for years that the measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you beat down. You know, that's the stuff they're pushing. That the measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you beat down, when we know the true measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you lift up. Who you lift up. Do you fight for workers? Do you fight for families? Do you fight for those who must be seen and heard and deserve the dignity that comes with hard work? That's what we fight for. And when you know what what you stand for, you know what to fight for.
That was the vice president, of course, and the president speaking at a union hall in Pittsburgh in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania on Monday on Labor Day. Now, to be fair and balanced here, of course, as we always strive to be, you know that, Desi Doyen.
Of course.
I would play you what Donald Trump had to say to workers and union members on Labor Day. But Donald Trump apparently took Labor Day off from campaigning. Not an important day to get out there and speak to the forgotten workers, I guess. Or maybe he just forgot to speak to them.
Or maybe he had some work to do on the golf course.
Yeah, there you go. He had to tend to some fairways.
Yeah.
Apparently, he couldn't find any union workers, I guess, who wanted to talk to him, maybe. I don't know. At any of his non-union hotels, which I guess weren't on strike, so he could have talked to them. Anyway, I don't know. More on the I got nothing to play for you on there from Donald Trump on Labor Day, but more on the presidential race itself in a little bit. Unfortunately, that was not the only news to kick into high gear over the weekend and into the first unofficial week of fall. There was terrible news out of the two major wars raging around the globe. An Israeli-American family that became an international symbol in the struggle to free hostages from Hamas captivity in Gaza laid their son to rest on Monday after the discovery of his body and those of five other hostages brought a fresh outpouring of grief around the globe and hundreds of thousands in mass protests flooding the streets of Israel once again. Tens of thousands thronged a Jerusalem cemetery to pay their respects to Hirsch Goldberg Polin, who became one of the most recognizable faces of the nearly year-old hostage crisis. Many sobbed as his mother, Rachel Goldberg Polin, said that she hoped his death might be a turning point in the drawn-out negotiations for a ceasefire and hostage release in the nearly year-long war in Gaza. His father noted, quote, "We failed you. We all failed you. Maybe your death is the stone, the fuel that will bring home the 101 other hostages," he generously suggested. Addressing the family at the ceremony, Israel's president, Yitzhak Herzog, apologized for Hirsch's death on behalf of the state. He said, quote, "We are sorry we failed to protect you in the terrible failure of October 7. We are sorry we failed to bring you home safely. We are sorry that the country you immigrated to at the age of 7, wrapped in the Israeli flag, failed to keep you." Goldberg Polin, a native of Berkeley, California, was attending a music festival when the Hamas-led militants stormed into southern Israel last October 7. About 250 hostages were seized by Hamas, which killed 1,200 people, most of them civilians. In the Gaza war that followed, Israel forces have since killed more than 40,000 Palestinians, the large majority of them also civilians, largely women and children. Israel's military announced Sunday that the bodies of Goldberg Polin and the five others had been discovered in an underground tunnel in the southern Gaza Strip. Israeli forensics experts reported that they had been shot at close range and died about 2 days earlier, shortly before Israeli troops reached the tunnel in southern Gaza, where they were held. Their deaths sparked protests by hundreds of thousands of people in Israel against the government there, with many saying the hostages could have been returned alive if a ceasefire deal had been reached. Hamas accuses Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of dragging out ceasefire talks by issuing new demands, including for lasting control over strategic corridors, specifically in Gaza. Netanyahu claimed on Monday night that he has accepted President Joe Biden's previous proposals and blamed Hamas, however, for the lack of progress. Netanyahu also blamed Hamas for the deaths of Goldberg Polin and the five others, saying whoever murders hostages does not want a deal. And that may be true, but neither does Netanyahu. In fact, I would argue that nobody wants a deal less than the far-right Israel prime minister at this point. He has defied protests at home and criticism from Joe Biden by vowing that Israel would not relinquish control along the Gaza-Egyptian border. And this is what's become key, apparently, to these negotiations. In a combative press release, according to The Guardian, the Israeli prime minister presented control of the Philadelphia corridor along Gaza's border with Egypt as a primary war aim, entrenching a position that has only recently emerged as a key obstacle to a ceasefire deal. Netanyahu's defiant remarks came just hours after the U.S. president met with his top advisors on the Gaza conflict and told reporters that he did not believe Netanyahu was doing enough to secure a ceasefire deal with Hamas. Of course he's not. Netanyahu has remained defiant over these claims by Israel to these strategic points in Gaza, despite significant internal and international pressure to secure at least a temporary ceasefire in the 11-month-old war. During his remarks on Monday, the Israeli prime minister briefly apologized to the families of the six hostages found dead in Gaza over the weekend, but then quickly pivoted to defend his government's control over the Philadelphia corridor, which has been seen as a non-starter for a potential ceasefire deal with Hamas. The Israeli opposition leader, Yair Lapid, derided Netanyahu's presentation as, quote, political spin with, quote, no relation to reality. Lapid said not one professional buys this spin. According to the Times of Israel, he said, not the security personnel, not the international systems, not the fighters who are actually in Gaza and know the reality there. The Philadelphia corridor has only emerged as an Israeli government talking point in recent weeks. It was not part of the plan that President Biden presented way back in May, which the Israeli government said at the time that it had accepted. The Hostage Families Forum vowed that their protests against the far-right Netanyahu government would continue after public anger erupted following the discovery of the hostages in a tunnel deep under the Palestinian city of Rafah. The Hostage Families Forum said that protests would continue in the interests of the 101 hostages who are still unaccounted for in Gaza, of whom Israeli intelligence believes about one-third are already dead. The group said the surviving hostages had been, quote, abandoned last week when Netanyahu's cabinet voted to stand behind the prime minister's apparently new negotiation position, insisting on Israeli control of that corridor. Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, a key hardliner, a right-winger in Netanyahu's government, vowed to continue to block any ceasefire deal. Quote, today, we have power in the government, Ben-Gvir told counter-demonstrators protesting in Jerusalem. Adding, quote, and I'm not ashamed to say that we're using this power to prevent a reckless deal and to stop any negotiations altogether, unquote. To stop any negotiations altogether. That's the National Security Minister of Israel. That seems to be the position of Netanyahu's right-wing Israeli government, even if it's in direct contradiction to hundreds of thousands of Israelis and the families of those still being held in Gaza. As I've been telling you now, for almost a year now, Netanyahu does not want a ceasefire or a hostage deal because it begins a road toward ending the war and, in the bargain, toward his removal from the government and toward pre-existing criminal felony charges that Netanyahu will finally be forced to face thereafter, after he is out of the government. Quote, unfortunately, there are too many things that are going on to obstruct a deal, said protester Debbie Mason, a social worker for a regional council in an area of southern Israel abutting Gaza, where many of the victims of the Hamas's October 7 attack lived. She said, whether it's on our side, whether it's on Hamas's side, it just doesn't seem to be in anyone's interest that something should happen, she said. She was speaking in Hostages Square, the plaza between the National Library and the Tel Aviv Art Museum, where hostage families and their supporters gather every day. Raya Carmen, a salesperson from a village near the Gaza frontier, pointed out what I've been trying to point out for months. She noted, according to The Guardian, that the Israeli protests against the war faced an immovable political reality, that if a ceasefire were agreed, Ben-Gvir, the national security minister, who told supporters he was using his power to, quote, stop any negotiations altogether, and his fellow right-wingers in Netanyahu's government would lead a far-right walkout from the cabinet, and Netanyahu's governing coalition would fall, removing Netanyahu's immunity against corruption charges that he faces in Israeli courts, as The Guardian spells it out. Yes, while serving as prime minister, Netanyahu enjoys immunity from prosecution, but not after he is no longer in office. Does any of that ring a bell? If this war ends, Netanyahu will be removed as prime minister and will be held to account for felony corruption charges filed before he became prime minister again not so long ago. Add to that, he will very possibly face war crimes charges now for what he has carried out in Gaza since then. So as I keep trying to explain, nobody wants this war to end less than Benjamin Netanyahu does, the guy who was supposed to agree to these negotiations somehow. As the protester Raya Carmen told The Guardian, if there is a ceasefire, the right-wingers will, quote, leave Netanyahu, and then he will be without a coalition, and he will have to go home, so he wants to stay as long as he can, unquote. So, what's the answer here? I have no idea, frankly. I believe this remains up to the Israeli people, however, to sort out if they really want peace. But as long as Netanyahu is in charge, this war will never end because he can't allow it to end. Protesters in the U.S., of course, have called for an embargo against sales of U.S. arms to Israel. The Biden-Harris administration has avoided that so far, even if they have prevented some offensive arms from being sent to Israel, some, very few. But the truth is, if the U.S. stopped sending arms to Israel today, they would still continue to wage this war in Gaza. They make many of their own munitions now. And in the bargain, walking away from Israel, well, that Israel might also take the opportunity to fall into coalition with a U.S. adversary that the U.S. administration preferred they did not. But as long as there is a criminal heading up the Israeli government, there will be no end to this bloodshed as I see it. And that, of course, is the danger of empowering a criminal at the top of your government. Yes, it very much echoes what Donald Trump is hoping to have for himself after this year's elections. And while I have no problem with those who wish to protest against the Biden-Harris administration for their position on Israel, that's just fine. Keep the pressure on. But please remember, when it comes time to vote this year, remember what the alternative will be if Trump, not Kamala Harris, wins this November. Do you think he would put any brakes whatsoever on Netanyahu? If you need a reminder, just look at the criminal who's in charge of Israel right now, who can't leave or he will go to jail. We will have the very same story here in the U.S., and none of that will be good for anybody, whether in Israel or in Gaza, as I see it. Or, by the way, for that matter, in Ukraine, where Donald Trump also supports the aggressor waging an apparently endless war. In Ukraine, on Tuesday, we have yet more evidence of a lawless regime in Russia, which as of now still faces no domestic accountability for an imperialistic invasion of its sovereign neighbor. Two ballistic missiles blasted a military academy and a nearby hospital Tuesday in Ukraine, killing more than 50 people, wounding more than 200 others, according to Ukrainian officials, in one of the deadliest Russian strikes since the war began. The governor of the region where the attack happened announced on Telegram that some 219 people were wounded and that 18 people may still be buried under the rubble. It was not clear whether the dead and wounded were limited to Ukrainian military personnel, such as Signal Corps cadets who studied at this academy, or if it included civilians as well. Because ever since it embarked on its full-scale invasion in early 2022, the Russian military has repeatedly used missiles to smash civilian targets, sometimes killing scores of people in a single attack. Some of the deadliest such assaults included the 2022 airstrike on a theater in Mariupol that killed hundreds of civilians sheltering in the basement there, and a strike that same year on a train station that killed 61. Apartment buildings, markets, and shopping centers have also been unlawfully targeted by Russia. Tuesday's attack happened as Ukrainian forces sought to carve out their own holdings in Russia, in the Kursk border region, after a surprise incursion that began early in August, the first mass encroachment in the 2.5-year war of Ukrainians into Russian territory. They now are said to hold some 500 miles of villages in Russia along its border with Ukraine. That as the Russian army has hacked its way deeper into eastern Ukraine. The strike on the military academy and the nearby hospital came on the day that Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Mongolia. There was no indication that his hosts there would heed demands to arrest him on an international warrant that he faces for alleged war crimes. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky repeated his appeal for Ukraine's Western partners to ensure swift delivery of military aid so they can defend themselves against this Russian onslaught. He has previously chided the U.S. and European countries for being too slow to make good on their pledges of help. Ukraine needs air defense systems and missiles now, he said, not sitting in storage, according to Zelensky in English on Telegram. Kamala Harris, the American Democratic nominee for president, has been clear about her continued support for Zelensky and Ukraine's defense. Donald Trump, the Republican nominee for president, has been clear about his support for Russian President Putin, the invaders. This November's election will very much affect what happens in that war as well, as if there was not already enough on the table in this country to be concerned about. So let's take a quick break here, and we will turn our focus to that election back here in this country. Now just over 60 days away, that's all, as the general campaign season launches in earnest. In a race that Politico characterizes today as, quote, the equivalent of a knife fight in a phone booth. That and more as we get caught up on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back, but don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Headed for the open door.
We'll see. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, and what the Worcester, Massachusetts Telegram and Gazette describes today is, quote, the almost ho-hum Massachusetts primary elections, with just a few state legislative contests on the September 3 ballot. Secretary of the Commonwealth William F. Galvin last week warn voters to be on the alert for a text claiming that they may be ineligible to vote. Voters in Massachusetts took to the polls on Tuesday in what is the penultimate congressional and state primary day of the year. With just one more week of primary elections next week in Rhode Island, Delaware, and New Hampshire. The last two of those states holding gubernatorial primaries next week still to go before we're on the straightaway to the general elections on November 5.
Wow.
So that's it.
Yep, and the dirty tricks are already underway.
The fake texts sent to some Massachusetts voters, which Secretary Galvin dubbed a scam, have been appearing in several districts in Middlesex County, according to reports filed by election officials in several municipalities. The suspicious texts reportedly tell recipients that they are ineligible to vote, and it directs them to click on a provided link. If you get a text like this that you don't expect, asking you to click on some particular link, frankly, if it's about elections or anything else, please don't do it.
Correct.
Galvin in Massachusetts believes the scam is a way to get recipients to share personal information. I don't know if that's what it's for or if it's meant as some form of voter suppression, though Massachusetts is a very blue state.
Well, why not both?
Well, there you go. Election officials in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, according to Galvin, do not reach out to voters via texts, though campaigns have access to voters' lists through local election officials. While Galvin downplayed the significance of the issue, he did warn Massachusetts voters to be on the alert for these texts and to report them to their local election officials if they get them. Nothing could be easier, he said, than checking either in person or online to determine whether someone is registered and eligible to vote. Call my office, Galvin said, adding that the information is available confidentially through both municipal elections officials and on the state's website. Voters can check their eligibility status, preview a party ballot, and even track their ballots if they use the mail-in ballot option in Massachusetts. Quote, there is no need to provide personal information, Galvin said, and even if a voter has been deemed inactive for some reason, if you look up your voter registration, you find out you're inactive, perhaps because you haven't voted in the last two general elections or for God knows any other reason that could occur, well, you can still exercise your right to vote by securing a provisional ballot, which will be counted, promises Galvin, as long as folks are properly registered, even if they are marked on the rolls as inactive. Galvin, a Democrat, says he is committed to protecting voters' rights to cast a ballot and, well, hopefully to have that ballot counted as cast. He mentioned that the text, he mentioned the text as he discussed the success of Massachusetts mail-in balloting and early in-person voting systems last week. Republicans, on the other hand, are developing quite a record this year already of working hard to prevent voters from voting. I don't know if they were behind these texts, but they're sure working hard in a lot of states to keep people from voting, and I hope to get to a number of those stories in a number of states in the coming days.
I just want to make sure that people remember, you know, you do need to, unfortunately, frequently check your registration to make sure it hasn't been purged or maybe an administrative error marking it inactive. But also be sure to tell other people, especially young voters who are now just getting acquainted with all the fun things that Republicans can do to keep them from voting.
Indeed. So, yeah, keep checking that. And by the way, early voting starts in some states, I believe, at the end of this week, beginning of next. For now, though, with all of that in mind, I think it's worth taking stock of where things stand, according to the latest polling. Yes, the horse race. We talk a lot about the track conditions. We will continue to do that. But it's important this year in particular to have an understanding of the horse race itself, what the expectations are for a number of reasons. So, taking stock of where things stand, according to the latest polling, after a very rocky summer, to say the least, as we head towards what I think I will call phase one of the election this year, the efforts by each party to win as many votes as they can by Election Day on November 5. And, in the case of Republicans, to prevent as many votes from being cast by certain people as many as they can in advance of Election Day. That's phase one of the elections this year. We will get to phase two, essentially everything that happens after the polls close on November 5. Well, we'll get to that also in the days ahead. And of course, we'll report any results or reported problems of note out of Massachusetts, where they voted on Tuesday, where Republicans are holding their own primary for the U.S. Senate to run against Elizabeth Warren, who is running unopposed on the Democratic side, as I say, in a very deep blue state. We'll get to that on our next broadcast if there is news of note. But for now, just to set the table for the moment, as Politico reports, Labor Day is a critical mile marker on the road to the general election, and Kamala Harris has reached it with a slim advantage over Donald Trump. But the former president would still be well within striking distance if the election were held today, they are correctly quick to note here. Because of Republicans' advantage in the Electoral College, a race that Harris leads nationally by between 2 and 4 percentage points on average, is actually the equivalent of a knife fight in a phone booth, as Politico calls it, in a particularly colorful, if apt, metaphor. And it is set to be decided in a smaller-than-usual number of states this year, they note. That said, given what I believe is likely to happen in phase two of the election, after Election Day, when Republicans, if they lose, will attempt to create all form of chaos, well, I believe that for those who hope Democrats win, running up the tallies everywhere, not just in the swing states, but everywhere for the Harris-Walz ticket will be an important post-election phase two strategy, if you will, as Republicans are planning to claim that the election was illegitimate if Trump loses once again. Bank on it. The polls, notes Politico, are extraordinarily tight in all of those few states that will ultimately determine at least phase one of the election. And that the Politico argues that is not expected to change much over the next 9 weeks. In modern presidential elections, they observe where the race stands on Labor Day is usually pretty close to where it ends up once the votes are counted. Of course, we have never seen a modern election day like this one, so take everything you hear about polling in particular with a grain of salt between now and Election Day. Of the 7 states that both campaigns identify as the core electoral college battlegrounds, Harris leads Trump in 3 of them. The so-called blue wall states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, according to multiple polling averages. But those leads are small in all of them. In only one state, only in Wisconsin, does an average show a greater than 3-point margin for the vice president. I mean, that's a polling error away. And we've seen a lot of polling errors in recent presidential elections. In 3 of the other battleground states, Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada, the polls are so close that different polling average sites have different leaders for each state as of this past weekend. Only in the remaining swing state, North Carolina, which Trump won in both 2016 and 2020, does the former president lead in all 3 of the major polling averages that Politico appears to be working from here, namely 538, Real Clear Politics, which leans quite hard to the right these days, and Silver Bulletin, which is a new data journalism site from the founder of 538, Nate Silver. But that lead in North Carolina is, as of Tuesday, less than 1 point. In fact, it is less than 1 point in all 3 of those states, less than 0.5 point in 2 of those polling average websites in 2 of those states. So couldn't be closer. Yes, a knife fight, and a phone booth. The three states where Harris has a modest lead, that would be the blue wall state of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Well, if she wins those, that would be sufficient to win the presidency. If she wins those three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, she gets those, and she holds on to all of the other traditional blue states, she wins as long as she earns the one electoral vote from Nebraska's second congressional district. You'll probably be hearing more about that district this year than you ever have before. Nebraska is one of just two states which actually split their electoral votes by congressional district. A recent poll released on Saturday from Split Ticket and Survey USA gave Kamala Harris a 5-point lead over Donald Trump in that one district in Nebraska. So, yeah. Winning all three blue states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and that one district in Nebraska will give Kamala Harris a victory by just one electoral vote, at least if the phase one numbers, you know, how people actually voted, if they hold up by the time we get to January 6th of next year. In short, Politico writes, Harris is narrowly ahead in those Rust Belt states, which would be enough to win. But Trump, Politico argues, is breathing down her neck. And those are also the states where the polling has been least accurate and specifically underestimated Donald Trump in the past two elections. Those three blue wall states. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton led Donald Trump in the pre-election polling in all three of those blue wall states back in 2016, only to lose them all. And Joe Biden's prospects looked like a slam dunk going into the 2020 election in those states. His numbers were higher than Kamala Harris's are right now, but he barely escaped with victories in both Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Remember that polling error I mentioned? So, yeah. It would be a mistake for anybody to count any chickens as of right now, despite the stunning, arguably unprecedented rise in the polls for the Harris-Walz ticket after Biden quit the race just about 6 weeks ago. Meanwhile, the candidates are essentially tied in the Sun Belt and Southern Tier states of Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina, the other four swing states, according to the polling averages, where Trump is narrowly leading in the only state that he won in both the past two elections that is now considered to be up for grabs. That would be North Carolina. Other than that, That's a big change from earlier in the summer when Donald Trump held consistent leads in all of those states and even in most of the blue wall states in many polls over Biden back when he was the presumptive nominee. That has all changed, but in the end, it's still going to be a very, very close race with about 9 weeks left until Election Day. But battleground state by battleground state, the race is careening toward another close finish.
That is so very close, shockingly close, disturbingly close, that democracy is still hanging by a thread here.
That's, of course, just one of the reasons the Democrats will be working so hard to turn out the vote. And one of the reasons Republicans are already working so hard to suppress as many votes as possible, by the way, including some 225,000 registered voters that they are seeking to remove from the rolls in, yes, North Carolina. But we will have to hold that story for another day because we got to get to a break. And we'll return with Desi Doyen and our Green News Report as she begins to get us caught up on what we missed taking a week off last week. In the climate, and a bunch of other stuff as well. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at The Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. just a bit of a heads up for our listeners in Southern California. We've had it pretty good here, actually, over much of the summer. I know most of the country has been just suffering under record heat. But there's this one little sort of pocket of cooler than average temperatures. And it happens to be right here in Southern California over the past few months.
Very, very lucky, at least on that score.
We have, but that luck is about to change, I fear. September and October are actually the warmest months in Southern California. And as it turns out, right on schedule, we're going to be seeing 100-plus degree heat, I am told, in the days ahead. In some areas, up to like 120 degrees, actually. So.
Yikes.
Be careful out there, Southern California. And speaking of, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
In this election, fundamental freedoms are at stake. The freedom to breathe clean air and drink clean water and live free from the pollution that fuels the climate crisis.
While we were out, catching up on climate and clean energy in the 2024 presidential race. Canada's wildfires last year emitted more carbon than India. Plus,
for the first time, you know, in 100 years beginning today, the river is actually coming back to life.
The mighty Klamath River is flowing freely for the first time in a century.
All of those good news stories and the rest straight ahead from BrandBlog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Do you still want to ban fracking?
No, and I made that clear on the debate stage in 2020 that I would not ban fracking. As vice president, I did not ban fracking. As president, I will not ban fracking.
Well, I guess she's going to ban fracking. This is your Green News Report. All right, Desi Doyen, we were only gone for a week, but during that week, fire and floods and heat spells and, boy, a whole bunch of stuff happened to the climate, didn't it?
Yes, as it usually does.
Uh-huh.
While we were out, a new analysis found that Canada's record-shattering wildfires last year were a top global emitter of climate-warming carbon dioxide, releasing as much as India's annual fossil fuel emissions. The researchers warned that ongoing man-made global warming risks turning nature's carbon sinks into net carbon emitters, generating a self-reinforcing feedback loop of warming. Here in the U.S., a new analysis in the Journal of the American Medical Association calculates that last year, extreme heat killed a record number of Americans. 2023 saw more heat-related deaths in the U.S. than any other year in 25 years of record keeping. Elsewhere, unusually intense monsoon rains triggered widespread flooding in Bangladesh that has displaced 2 million people. In Nigeria, relentless rains and floods have killed scores of people and washed away farmland, increasing concerns over food security. And Australia, where it is winter, just recorded its hottest August in more than a century of record keeping. In politics, while we were out, 2024 Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris at the Democratic National Convention pledged to act on climate change as a matter of freedom. In an interview with CNN late last week, Harris said she would build on President Biden's historic investments in climate and clean energy in the Inflation Reduction Act and explained why she no longer calls for a ban on fracking.
Investing in a clean energy economy, what we've already done, creating over 300,000 new clean energy jobs. What I have seen is that we can grow and we can increase a thriving clean energy economy without banning fracking.
Yeah, but is she going to ban fracking?
Well, also notably, CNN did not ask Harris any forward-looking policy questions about climate or energy. Harris has been endorsed by all major environmental and climate organizations, from the Sierra Club to the Sunrise Movement.
And there is a lot to look forward to that she certainly could have asked about, given the enormous record-breaking investment in climate action that the Biden-Harris administration has taken on.
Exactly.
Well done, Dana Bash.
On the same day in Wisconsin, Republican presidential nominee and climate science denier Donald Trump promised again to expand fossil fuels that cause dangerous climate change and incoherently claimed that people can't eat bacon now because of wind energy somehow. But there's also some good news. While we were out in Alaska, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland revoked a Trump administration order that tried to open up 28 million pristine acres to energy development and mining. She said it violated federal law. The decision was supported by Alaska Native tribal groups, and it restores the 50-year ban on energy development in the area.
Nice.
China has achieved its renewable electricity target 6 years early, with wind and solar deployment surpassing its 2030 goal.
Well, what do you know? It's not all that hard if you actually try.
In Norway, electric car sales set a new world record, taking a 94% share of Norway's market in August.
Wow.
And finally, on the California-Oregon border, in a significant win for tribal nations, the mighty Klamath River is flowing freely again. The largest dam removal project in U.S. history is finally complete after crews demolished the last of four century-old dams along the Klamath that had decimated its salmon and other species and degraded water quality. The land has been returned to the tribes as work begins to restore 400 miles of salmon habitat.
Excellent news. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Good news. For all of our listeners in Oregon and up in Northern California on that Klamath River.
Yeah, this is really huge news, and the recovery of that river and its ecosystem will supply food for millennia.
Long overdue.
Yes.
And it suggests that a similar project down here with the LA River may somehow also someday come back to life from the concrete tunnels that it now is, and they're trying to restore that one as well.
Exactly, and it makes a huge difference, so it's good work moving forward.
All right, we got to get out moving forward. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always appreciated. It is always our honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. There is no paywall there, thanks to those of you kind enough and generous enough to hit a donate button or go to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and make it through this
insane
election season. There you go. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebook, Mastodon's, the site still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Coming to the edge, right?